Thursday, March 20th, 2008. I am H.F. Williamson. I am interviewing George Myers for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress American Folklife Center. We are at Studio X, Campbell Hall, on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. Henry Radcliffe is the director of lighting, sound, and camera. George, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your background before you went into service and how you came to join the Navy.
Be glad to. Back at that time, you had no choice. You were going to be in the service. And I was a farm boy. And my mother was a widow. We were on a poor farm, small farm up by Hoopston. And maybe I could have been drafted to the farm, but I didn't choose to be because I was going to college when the war broke out. Well, I had 3 years of college, and when the war broke out, I had dropped out for a semester trying to decide what I was going to do. I was in the ROTC here at the University of Illinois, and starting the third year, I would have to have signed up for an advanced corps training in the Army. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to be in the Army. I'd seen enough of the ROTC that I had questions. Is there something better? I didn't know of anything. I didn't know of anything except that the naval publicity looked pretty good to me. And I had grown up in the time when the United States were very much stuck on isolationism, and I can remember those pictures in the newspapers of pieces of humanity that were slaughtered in World War I, and they really turned me off. And I didn't wish to get into this, but I knew I had to be. I could just imagine the millions of people that would be slaughtered, and was there a better way for me to serve? And so while I was at home, I decided possibly a naval program would fit for me. And I think it was April of 42, while I was home, I joined the Navy V7 program. That was the ROTC for the Navy, but it operated differently than the Army, because ROTC in the Army, we were marching and doing this and that and setting guns up and so forth, but they weren't equipped. We had brooms that we were carrying around instead of real rifles. Early on, when I was in basic ROTC, we had Enfield rifles that had been used in World War I. But when the war broke out, they took all those to war somewhere. They weren't drilling with them. And so I joined the V7 program, which would allow me to take courses getting ready for naval service. I took spherical trigonometry. Spherical. So you could have 390-degree angles in a sphere, on a sphere. So it was different. I took astronomy. I took math. I took things that I thought might be of help to me. And I didn't know what was going to happen. So when I went to summer school to get out earlier. When I got out of summer school in the fall of 43, I waited until they called me, the Navy called me. I got very impatient because I wondered what was going on. My friends that were that I'd served with and knew were getting going through a lot of hell. And I, here I was sitting it out. And I was glad to, but I felt I wasn't doing my part. I had a classmate at high school at Hoopston, my same class. He joined the V-5 program, which was the naval area officer training for naval pilots. And he was in all kinds of combat. When the war was over, he had 12 or 13 Japanese planes he shot down. He was a super hero and awfully lucky to have survived. I don't see how a man could have gone through as much as he did. The ROTC people that I was with, they were already in the service, and they were catching all kinds of hell, and I was on the outside. When I was called up, lo and behold, I was assigned to the amphibs. Hadn't even heard of them. I don't think anybody in the country had heard of the amphibs, really. And even to this day, they don't know very little about them, because the amphibs were the new ship, the LST, that could land on beaches. And that was, I think, a surprise to both Japan and Germany, that a big ship, longer than a football field, and could carry heavy tanks, armament, 400 men or more ashore, put them ashore on a beach, and then retract from the beach and go back for another load. I didn't know anything about that. I was sent to Camp Bradfordton on the East Coast, close to Norfolk, and there they were putting our crews together. And I got to be, got assigned a crew.
So you had been commissioned as an ensign?
Yes. There was another step in here that I haven't mentioned, that after I got out of college, they called me up for midshipman training at Notre Dame. And so in 90 days, I was one of those wonders. Had a commission in the Navy. I hadn't ever seen the darned ocean yet. And I wasn't very confident in that, but they had done a tremendous job of teaching us what we needed to know, giving us the bookwork and that sort of thing. And we were well prepared, because the Navy, in their wisdom, had put half a dozen or so tried and true veterans on the ship with us. And one such a veteran was a guy by the name of Whitehead, who'd been an enlisted man in the Navy, had been on a destroyer that was sunk in the Coral Sea. He said that they were in formation, in a column, and caught some fire, and their destroyer was hit and sunk before the ship immediately behind them come to that spot. The ship just went on through there. The other ships went right on through there, and these guys were down in the water, and there was only 9 people on that destroyer that survived, and he was assigned to our ship. And he was an enlisted man that was what we called a Mustang, that he got a commission while he was in the service for the kind of work that he did, and he was a tremendous leader for us. And one of the things that I've done in recent years, 50 years after we served, and now it's 60, we started looking for the crew that was on our LST 635. And 3 of us searched and needle in the haystack. It's very hard to find those people. And we found enough to have a reunion. And this year, next month, we'll have our 11th reunion. And there'll be about six or seven of the original crew, but there'll be other people that are family and that sort of thing that'll be there at the reunion. We'll have about 30 people down at Tampa, Florida.
How nice.
And one of the things I never, ever expected, we find that we were very, very close. We served together. We weren't particular friends. We were just serving together. And when we searched for the crew and found enough to have a reunion, it was a love feast. Our wives and our families all bought into it, and I have another family. It's being depleted by years now, that of the people that I served on an LST with. Just as an example, I have gotten active in the Illinois LST Association. I got into that because I thought maybe it would help us find crew members in the National Association. And I've been president of the Illinois Association twice. So total, I've been president for 4 years. But those contacts that I've made through the associations helped me to find more of our crew, helped some people who had lost loved ones aboard an LST, like the 577. I met some people down in Florida one time and was telling me that there was a brother-in-law that had been lost on that ship. They never knew what happened to the ship. I found that information through the contacts I had, and I found a world of information because there were others that were looking for the information, and they put it together and made a log of it.
So this bond started...
Pardon?
The bond which you established with the men and your crew started on the East Coast right after you'd been through the 90-day program at Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of training did you have? Was your ship there, or were you just training on... Was that LST there?
They had a couple of LSTs there. Most of our training was on the shore, but they had some LSTs that they would assign us on a cruise, and we went on some cruises on the East Coast, and it was sort of a shakedown for a crew, and we got the experience that we needed. Now this
was roughly the 100 men that would later serve on the same craft. So they had you grouped together already.
They grouped us there on the East Coast, and after this training that we had, they put us on a troop train, and it was July. God, it was hot, and there was no air conditioning, and we went through the tunnels with the windows down and the steam engine or the coal-fired engine blowing smoke out in the tunnels. When we got to Navy Pier in Chicago, our naval whites were just black with sweat and all that soot. And that was probably one of the first experiences I had with crew.
Was that just a stopover in Chicago, or was there more training there?
Okay, they sent us to Navy Pier, and lo and behold, they were building LSTs a few miles from Chicago on the Illinois River at Seneca, Illinois. Here was a little town of about 2,000 people, and they were building LSTs there. They built 157 LSTs at Seneca, and they had 20,000 people working there in the shipyards.
Wow.
It was close enough to Chicago and close enough to the rural areas that they had people coming in to work in the shipyard. And it was quite a show.
Is that where your ship was built?
Our ship was built at Seneca. It was 635, and it was launched, I think, in August of 44. Those of us that were in the original crew, we called them plank owners, and we plank owners were there, and they launched the LST sideways in the river because the river wasn't wide enough to launch it in a conventional way. And one of the things that's been very interesting to me is that the Illinois LST Association has been holding their monthly meetings in Seneca. And the library at Seneca has got quite a bit of information about LSTs, that activity that was there during World War II. And 2 years ago, our association built a monument in Crotty Park at Seneca, commemorating LSTs. And so there's something there that for generations to see, that Seneca was a very important place during World War II. Not a thing left. Still only about 2,000 people live there. There's not a sign of the shipyard. It's all gone. But at one time it was a tremendously busy spot close to Chicago on the river, and we went and it launched the LST into the river. They put our crew on the ship, but they include the Coast Guard people on board the LST to navigate the river. And we went down the river, we went under the bridges, and hi there was people on the bridges watching us go through, and we were almost close enough to the people on the bridge that they could hand cigarettes down to us and that sort of thing, and it was quite a show. But we went down the river, and lo and behold, the river had trees along the side, so you couldn't see what towns or anything you were going through. Just we were going down the river till we got down to New Orleans, and then they finished construction of the LST, put the masts and the parts of the ship above the main deck on the ship, because it couldn't have them on and get under the bridges.
Right.
And so then we went from there, after we got fitted for a shakedown in the Caribbean, and we made an invasion on one of the towns there in Florida. And of course, they didn't tell the townspeople what was going on. There were military people there, and there was an alarm that went out, and all of the people in the military had to report, and so forth and so forth. It was a training for shore people as well as the ship.
How many of the LSTs were in your flotilla?
Come again?
How many of the ships were in your flotilla, in your group, in this invasion?
Or how many ships in the flotilla?
Yeah.
You know?
Roughly.
I think a dozen, but we never saw those ships. I don't know how they did it, but we were all independent. After we got our shakedown and they loaded us with fuel and everything you needed to go overseas, we went through the Panama Canal, and I think there was two ships going all the way. The next morning after we went through the canal zone, it was a little reassuring to look out, see destroyers out there going back and forth and protecting us, and that was all day. And then the next night, after the next night, we got up. There was nothing there, no destroyers. We were on our own.
One ship?
It was two ships.
Two ships.
But LSDs don't have the kind of armament to protect themselves very much. We just felt we were expendable. And excuse me. We traveled all over the Pacific. We went by ourselves. Except when we were making the big invasion in the Lingayen Gulf, there was all kinds of support there. But most of the time, we traveled alone. And when we had a load of troops on, we were important enough to have an escort. But I'd say 95% of the time, we just traveled by ourselves in the Pacific. It's a big, big ocean. We were 30 days outside of land, going from Panama Canal Zone to New Hebrides Islands, Manus Island, that area. 30 days, we never saw anything, any land, occasionally a ship.
How did your commanding officers know where you were and know if you were going to arrive safely, or they didn't?
Well, that was before a lot of things we have now, but Navy people have been, or ships have been traveling the oceans for generations and generations. One of the things that the training I had was to be a navigator. And you took I guess you call it an azimuth, and you took a reading on the star, pull it down to the horizon, write that down to the second, and then find another star and bring it down and write it down, and then go in the chart room and we could figure out where we were by celestial navigation. I was a navigator. We were off the coast of China quite a bit later, and I was rousted out of the sack one morning right after sunrise, and the guy shook me and said, "Come on, come here, get up here. The sun come up in the wrong direction this morning." The azimuth, or the, what do you call that? The gyro compass had gone out during the night, and the thing had been just swinging around like that, and our ship had been falling around, and so we didn't know where we were, except that we were following this gyro, and I had only done celestial navigation, so I knew there was in the training they give you a lot of things. I knew that you could do sun lines. So the only time I ever did a sun lines was that morning, and I did some sun lines on where the sun was and brought it down to the horizon and found where we were. That's when you felt good about the training you had, that they trained you on many things that you'll never use, but who knows, maybe you would sometime. So
was navigation officer your primary duty, or did you have other duties as one of the officers?
I was an officer aboard a ship of nine officers aboard on the assigned to the ship, and I was the communication officer, and the radio room was my responsibility, and we had about four or five radio men there taking messages. And then sometimes they were coded, and then I had the secret code that I could decode those messages. But that was my main responsibility, was a communications officer. I was navigator not all the time I was aboard the ship.
So let me come back to this You left the Panama Canal, and 30 days later, you arrived at your port, destination port, where you were going to be put into a, well, whatever. Go ahead. What happened then?
We never did arrive at ports, as you'd say. Espirito Santo was just an island, and we were a bunch of LSTs, and we just go up on the beach.
Okay.
Our ship was loaded with all kinds of war material, and it was packed full. And then on the deck there was an LCT, a little landing ship that would go on a beach and had a crew of, I think, 10. And LST is a remarkable ship. It was designed by a submarine architect. So when we got to Manus Island and we wanted to get rid of, to launch our LCT off the deck, we just released all the cables that fastened it, pumped the water out of one side, made the ship lurch over to the side because of the tanks, and slid off in the water.
Huh. It worked. I take it that worked. It didn't sink or anything silly like that, no.
And everything that was you were hauling on an LST was always buckled down, because an LST is a flat-bottom ship, and I don't know how they could survive in the Atlantic, but the Pacific, for the most part, is very calm, and so it was just kind of a cruise. Now we got into one or two, what do we call them?
Typhoons or?
Typhoon. In fact, there's a typhoon that right at the end of the World War II, when we would have been getting ready to go to Japan, we'd have had a big problem with that typhoon. That typhoon was so strong that some capital ships sank, but were broken up. But LSTs all rotted out, and it was a long, flexible ship. And some people said it kind of snakes through the water. Well, when you're in that kind of water, you could see the ship, the deck bending. If you're down below, the bulkheads would crack and pop as the stress went on them, but the ship could ride those things out. Wow. It's a remarkably well-designed ship.
Why don't you tell us what you were doing after you arrived in the Pacific Theater? What sorts of activities were involved?
Well, we were assigned to MacArthur's group, and he started down in New Guinea. From Manus we went to New Guinea, and Jim Fisher had a lot of experience in that area. He's going to be talking to you later. We went into New Guinea at Itapi and Hollandia and loaded up equipment and personnel to take up to the Lingayen Gulf invasion, and that's the first activity we saw. And that was a humongous operation. Ships as far as you could see, 13 miles that way, 13 miles that way, 13, 13, and you were just in the center of that, as far as you could see, were ships. Down in New Guinea, we loaded up to make the invasion in the Philippines.
And you were saying you had personnel as well as equipment on your...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We'd have...
Were these Marines or...?
Well, I believe in every case they were Army.
Okay.
We might have had Marines on at one time, but we had Army personnel. And I remember we had one group that were part of MacArthur's headquarters, and I can still picture the little, shouldn't say little, but the army guy. He didn't have any rank, but he felt like he was responsible for these things that were MacArthur's, and he had more say than you could imagine because he was protecting MacArthur's equipment on board. MacArthur, I have a great admiration for him, because what we were doing, taking a part of, was going from one island where he secured a perimeter and put in an airfield, and then we'd pick that up and secure another perimeter, pick that up, secure another one. We went all the way to Philippines and then Japan by just island hopping. And MacArthur didn't care, didn't seem to worry about the Japanese that were in the caves and that sort of thing. The battles that you heard about, this horrific battles of dragging the Japanese out of the caves, very little of that happened under MacArthur's command, because all he was interested in was securing a perimeter. If there were caves there, he had to do that. But we just island hopped all the way to the Philippines, and then we were getting ready to make the invasion of Japan when we were out to sea somewhere when the notice came through over the radio. And that was a part of the thing that I had responsibility for, that the war was over. And
had you already heard that they had dropped the first atom bomb?
We heard about the bombs.
Right, and then the end of the war.
And then the end of the war come a few days later. I felt a little bit frustrated. I had a little bit of scientific training here at U of I, and I was very blown away with the idea of an atomic bomb. And I can remember I was talking to different members on our ship, and they said, oh, it's just another bomb. Well, no, I'm trying to say this is the beginning of a new age, an atomic age. And then come the surrender of Japan, because it was a terrific bomb. And so then after the war was over, I was on a couple islands in Japan. We went to Yokohama and on Liberty while we were on Japan. And the thing that impressed me so much, the war had been over just a matter of a few weeks. I doubt whether these Japanese folks had seen any Americans. But we went on Liberty, and we went on Liberty after dark, just two or three, four of us, separately, and we didn't feel that we were in any danger at all. We might have been, but we didn't feel that we were, and I never heard of the Japanese taking out any of their anger on the Americans. If it was our country, I don't know whether we couldn't walk through the dark streets of Chicago, let alone like we were walking through the streets of Japan immediately after the war. The other thing that I was so impressed about the Japanese, that we had just destroyed so much of that country. Ginza Strip was a very industrial and developed area is what I'm trying to say, and that was gone. This is Ginza Street. Well, there was nothing there but a park, green grass and everything. They picked up all the refuse and did something with it. We were in Japan and in China and other places, and the rubble from previous wars were still there. And here, a month after the war was over, the Japanese had cleaned up the debris that in the areas where I was. They were very, very, very industrious people. And I've had an opportunity. We had an opportunity to, immediately after the war, to go to China also. And fact was that I got rotated off before the ship was decommissioned in the Yangpu River of China. But I had been there with the ship in the Yangpu, and I had to, I come away from experience aboard this ship of a lot of respect for the Asiatic people. They're different, but they're all, I just have an enormous respect for them. And
what was your ship doing something military when it was down on the China, in China, or?
Well, we were doing things that, just like we were just moving personnel and equipment around. When we went to Japan, or China, sort of a revolution going on in China, and we were moving what I kind of said. Well, we were moving the Chinese around so they could continue their revolution.
So these were the Chiang Kai-shek troops, perhaps.
Being, yeah, I can't quite.
Right.
But we, the World War II was over, but something else was going on in China.
Quite.
After the war, we had United Nations Relief Organization, UNRWA, and you got over to China, you had CNRA, C-N-R-A. And so we were moving stuff in that the Chinese needed. And every country, every place you go is different. And so I can remember we had unloaded stuff, and it seemed that the stuff was unloaded on China, and then when you go through a certain province, each province had its own autonomy. And so if you're going to go through here, we're going to take this and this, is the way it seemed to work.
So the provincial officials took their payments.
And so as it went from around and around, the local people, the local government seemed to be able and allowed to sort of tax the stuff that was going through. They'd take theirs, what they want, let the rest go through. It was an interesting thing to observe.
Interesting administrative situation. You're a naval vessel, but you're being taxed by the local government, so to speak.
No, this was the equipment, the things that we hauled in there.
Yeah, but you're still,
you're
a naval
vessel.
American
stuff was Chinese relief.
Okay.
But I understand. How much it was going to get where it needed to be, well, maybe that's just the way it was done.
Well, but before we talk about your leaving the service, would you like to go back and discuss any of the invasions that your craft was on? I mean, what would happen in an invasion? Would you be landing early in the invasion or later after the beachhead had been established? How did these work?
Well, Jim Fisher can talk more about that because, as a matter of fact, when we made the beaches, no one ever fired at us. Things were pretty well secured. So I had a trip in a cruise that was very uneventful, even the fact that I can show you about 20 different places in the Pacific that we were, it was uneventful as far as combat. We were just moving things.
So you were like a truck on water. You were the transportation corps of the Navy.
Yes, that's it. What it was, in the Army. I mean, we carry 50-ton tanks on that LSD.
Wow.
And put them ashore. But most of the things we were, the things that you needed for a war or for rehabilitation, we were bringing ashore. And then there was the red ball lines. These were, there were a whole series of trucks with red balls painted on them.
Right.
And those, they'd load those trucks up and then travel terrific speeds. We were just bringing it to where these kind of people could get a hold of it and run with it, go with it.
So it must have given you an appreciation for all of the logistics that go on in planning a battle, all the things behind the scenes that have to occur.
I don't know about the logistics.
Well, but you were part of those logistics in the sense that you were, your ship was, I mean.
Yes. We just took the orders and carried out what we were assigned to do. We were not heroes on the 635. Now you're going to talk to some other people that are heroes and that lost people in combat. We didn't lose anybody in combat. We lost some people, but that's still some more stories. But it was in...
Did you want to talk about any of the losses that you had?
The what?
Did you want to talk about any of the losses that occurred on your ship, or...?
We didn't really have any losses.
Oh, okay. You said you lost some people non-combat.
Well, we had people that... we had one that I felt so badly about. We had a full-blooded Indian. I can't recall what tribe he was. His name was Blue Arm. And he got sick and died aboard our ship.
Oh.
And it turned out that it was some kind of a... a disease that was in his inheritance, the poor guy died, and we are landlubbers, and so I wasn't a part of it, but I knew it happened. They put him in the cooler till we got to back on land, and oh my, he should have been buried at sea. We didn't do that because we weren't into that kind of thing. One time, we had a very, very competent a pharmacist mate, and since we were flagship, we got word that there was a man that was sick on board another LST. He seemed to have appendicitis. And so our pharmacist mate got on board the small boat and went over to the other LST. He performed an appendectomy on this sailor. He'd never seen it done, but it needed to be done, and he had a medical doctor on the telephone talking to him as he did it. The guy survived and did all right. I've heard stories being told that this happened in other aboard other ships, but aboard our pharmacist mate performed a appendectomy. He was a good pharmacist mate, but he'd never seen an appendectomy operation, but he performed one without having seen one. There's things like that happened. There were a lot of heroes out there in the war, but they were so many, most of them were unknown, like this Mustang ensign that just took command of our, took control of our ship and saw that we knew how to survive in combat and so forth. He was the real hero that I saw in the my naval period, because he knew what had to be done. He knew how to train us to do it, and he was real hard on us at any time, night or day, that he thought that we ought to be alerted to what to do if such and such a thing happened.
How many ships were under the command of your flag officer?
You know, I don't know. Around a dozen, yeah. I guess.
So did you move as a group, or were you?
Never as a group.
I see.
And we moved LSTs around, and here'd be an LST we'd never seen before, and another one we hadn't seen before, and we'd move together. And then next time it'd be some other. I don't know. There was a lot of organization that I didn't see, but it worked. I didn't see any snafus that were serious, except like I'm thinking about the fact that we were a flagship, and we had two lieutenants assigned, one for the skipper and one was the executive officer, and they were trained with the idea that they were in command of the ship. And they were. But here come a flag officer aboard who was an academy man, who he was a commander, who I doubt whether he'd had a very auspicious naval career up to that point. He probably had been retired from the Navy because he couldn't be promoted, but the war came along, and here he was out there as a as our flag officer. And he was out there to make a name for himself. And he was in charge of everything. And the skipper and the exec said, well, we thought we were supposed to be in charge. They were supposed to be in charge.
Of the ship, yeah.
So, you know, that was an unsatisfactory situation. So the commander had our skipper and our executive officer court-martialed for on a trumped-up charge, so get him off the ship so he could be what he wanted to be.
Did it work? Did they leave the ship?
He got rid of him.
Oh, my gosh.
And we got two more officers to be skipper and executive, and they were good officers, and so there was no loss, really, as far as our ship was concerned. I just feel bad for the careers of the previous exec and skipper, but of course they were just reservists like I was. And so that was just a part of their career, and it shouldn't have ruined their life, but it was a very hard thing to see. This skipper, this commander, none of us had much no good feeling for him, because he was trying to make a career, and we were just trying to get the war over. And so he would take charge. I could show you that when somebody would see something floating out in the ocean, and he'd come up and pronounce it this or that, and somebody else would say, "Well, I don't think so." But he, whatever he said, he would stick by it, and he was always wrong. For example, we had these small boats that go ashore, back and forth ashore. One time he took the small boat ashore, and the coxswain, of course, was piloting the small boat where he knew he should be. And the commander said, "Oh, go over here. Go this way." "No, that's not the way to go." I said, "Go this way." And so they run the small boat aground, or hit a coral reef, and had to back off and made the trip around and come back and tied the small boat up to the boom. And that night, the small boat sank. And so the commander come up the next day and found out who was the officer of the deck when the small boat sank. He didn't tell anybody that he'd had an accident with the boat. The coxswain knew about it, and he told us. The boat sank, and he wrote a reprimand in the officer of the deck's jacket for allowing that thing to happen. He was just focused on what he saw that might make a career for himself, and not winning the war or anything like that. And he probably saved our lives, because Jim, that we'll be talking to you, probably made 10 invasions. And we were out there going kind of like on a cruise, because this commander didn't get our ship in any trouble.
I see.
But it was an experience of a lifetime that was compressed in 4 years.
So now that the war is over and you're still working, the ship is still transporting things, how did it come that you were finally discharged from the service?
Come again?
What was the circumstances of your discharge?
Oh, when I got my points, everyone, depending on their points, and their points were by age and by the time you served, and by dependents. I had no dependents, so my points didn't come up till way late, and that's the best part of my whole naval experience, was that the war was over, and I could have gone home if I had the points, but since I didn't have the points, I made trips to Japan and China and some of those exotic places that I'd never seen without we were just going places during the war where we were assigned. It wouldn't be places you would go, except, well, some of them were. Those South Sea Islands, some of them are beautiful places. I wouldn't mind going back and visiting some, but I never will make it now. But I have a son who is very successful in tool and die. He has started out in a little shop in Chicago working for the owner of the shop, and he got to do everything in the shop, and then do everything in the office, do everything out on sales, and then he bought the business, then he expanded in other shops in the United States, and then down in Florida, Fort Lauderdale. Then he had a factory in Scotland, and then he had a factory in Singapore for years and years. And he's gotten rid of all those, and now he's got factories in China and Malaysia. So I have some contacts there in the Orient, after all, through my son.
Right.
It's been a wonderful experience for me. I was just a country boy, still am. I've worked agriculture all my life, and I've been lucky. I know how to handle agriculture. And I own farmland that I got through being able to do that.
Now, was there one other story about when you finally were discharged on your flight back home? Was that?
Well, we were in Hong Kong when I got my orders to come back home. And since I was an officer, and they were flying some war-weary bombers back to the United States, and I had an opportunity to fly back to the United States. Well, I wouldn't have chose that, but hey, why not? I've been through everything else, and while I had climbed through B-29s and Tinian, I'd never been in the air with any bombers. So I said, sure, I'll fly back. And when we got aboard that bomber, it just had a bomb bay. There was no seats, no nothing in there, but just a cargo area. And lo and behold, we flew through a storm. Wow, that you were dropping, and then you were in an updraft, and so you'd be laying there wrapped up in a blanket and getting uneasy and thinking, oh, maybe I better get up, sit up. And so then you'd try to sit up, and you were in an updraft. You couldn't get up, so we have to try it a little harder. And so the next time when you try to get up, you were in a downdraft, and you just throw yourself in the air. So we were just rattling around in that thing, and it would have been a lot of fun if we weren't as scared as we were, and it was pitch black in that cargo hatch. But it was an experience.
And you made it.
Yeah. We made it everywhere. Everything was quite an interesting experience.
So when you returned to the States by that flight, and then did you take a train back to Illinois? Where were you? Where was your final discharge?
Well, it was kind of fuzzy because I was in the reserves.
Oh.
And I was released from active duty, and I think that was out in California. And I was assigned Treasure Island, right by San Francisco. So I was there about a month. They looked at us as naval officers that just got back from overseas, and they. And I was signed for security, and I was investigating some property that had been supposedly lost and so forth. But my heart wasn't in it. Even if I was on the track to solve it, I didn't solve any of the problems that I was assigned to. And the other thing was that. Here I hadn't just barely got back to the United States, and the darned the president was Truman. Not the Coast Guard, but the Navy people went out on strike, and lo and behold, here's people that had been in the United States.
The longshoremen went on strike, or
what?
The longshoremen went on strike, or the people loading the cargoes went on strike, or
well, these were just ships out in the harbor in
San Francisco, or
in San Francisco, and the civilians that were manning the ships had gone on a strike, And here I was just getting back from the service from overseas, and I got assigned to be in charge of a ship out in the harbor. Well, there was a way to do it, I guess, but I thought that was something that I didn't have to have, but I did.
So they sort of nationalized the private ships and put the naval officers in charge, and you were one of them. Oh, my gosh.
But it was solved, so I never took the ship out or anything.
You finally did get home.
I did get home and come back to the home farm. And it all started because we were not very successful. Mother had been widowed 10 years in 31. My mother was widowed, and we lost my father and brother in a drowning accident. They were trying to save some people that were in the water. And a preacher, my father, and my 12-year-old brother were drowned in an effort to save somebody that was out in the Mississippi River, and we didn't really know what was going on. Looking back at it after it had happened, there was a river barge went by, and we should have known that would make an undertow and current. We didn't know it. We weren't swimming, but there were some other people swimming, and my father and the preacher and my brother made a living chain and tried to reach out to them, but somebody in the chain didn't